Today, we're talking about a really interesting topic, about the next industry revolution. We're talking not about robots replacing humans, but more about freeing humans up to do what they can't do and what robots actually can do. And we have a new buzzword. Maybe it's not even a buzzword, but we're going to talk about this. It's called Industry 5.0.
Rob Talk, the Autonomous Robotics Podcast. Physical AI, no theory, just reality.
And Industry 5.0 is the topic everybody's talking about. But is it just a rebranding of Industry 4.0 that we coined in Germany especially? And that's what we're going to talk about today and how that is actually impacting the world of manufacturing and obviously the future of all of us. So welcome, Clemens. We have Clemens here, one of the principal engineers at Robco. Thank you for being with us again. And I can only say you have such an amazing deep insight into, you know, the whole robotics and how robots are actually working and, you know, how to really make them autonomous. So this is really amazing to have you here. But yeah, take us into Industry 1.0 up to 4.0 and tell us what this actually means and what are the different stepping stones in our history of humans.
Humans have created stuff since they have been around, right? So probably we already manufactured things on a broader scale since the Bronze Age. If you think of cauldrons, mm-hmm. right? You have to do them. You know, they're standardized products. Or if you think about the Roman Empire and you have to create the helmets for an army. And actually, if you think about the German term for factory, mm-hmm. Fabrik, mm-hmm. it comes from the Latin faber, which is the craftsman. I think we've had this tendency. So it's about creating stuff. It's about manufacturing, mm-hmm. And so even before the Industrial Revolution, we had things like water mills, mm-hmm. right? And so in the 18th century already, we had things like having to put people in one place so that they can produce things efficiently. Because, for example, you had only a water source or a power source, or you had to buy a big machine to do stuff in one place. And so that's where the whole factory idea not came about, but it was established more and more. And obviously the big thing that then changed a lot was the steam engine in the mm-hmm. 18th century.
Constant power, right?
Constant power, and also in some sense, mobility. Before, you had a water source, but mm-hmm. the water source was kind of flaky, or it had a windmill. So you could do like a hammersmith could run the smith without without electricity or without coal. Yeah. But now we could do this on a much bigger scale, but we also had to put these huge engines, which you know cost a lot of money, in one place.
Yeah,
that's where the Industrial Revolution started, which we call now one of the most defining events in human history.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the Roman Empire, because they must have produced thousands of helmets, and these helmets must have all been kind of different, and long time was a hard time to produce them. And then obviously with the introduction of also the water sources and the wind sources, but then especially the steam engine, there was a strong amount of power in a where you could basically build it wherever you wanted, so even close to cities where you had a lot of workforce. And I think that's the first time where the manufacturing really became possible in a kind of like a more controlled way, I guess.
I mean, there's tons of examples around that. If you think about building a fleet of ships, mm-hmm. we already had in Venice a huge shipyard where they already had kind of mass production in the shipping industry.
Interesting.
If you think of Rome or Baghdad, these were cities with a million people in. Obviously, you probably had mass production of just bread.
True.
Right? But without a lot of machines. So now we have machines, and now we have things like the mechanical loom, which brought a 40 times improvement in productivity. Mm-hmm. So before that, it was pretty funny how fabrics were made, right? It was the first instance of the home office. So there was a merchant, and they distributed the tasks to people who then went home and had their little looms at home,
yeah.
And then they brought the stuff back, and so suddenly that was centralized with the mechanical loom, and you suddenly had workers like thousands of workers in one place, and initially. We had only one engine, and then much later, you could even have like smaller motors to do that and much more effectively.
Would you say that was basically like Industry 1.0?
That was what was then later called Industry 1.0. I mean, nobody called it that way at that point, but in hindsight, this was the big shift that things got centralized. You get now factory owners being separate from the factory workers. Factories being at a different place than the point of sale. That's also the difference between certain kind of shops, like a bakery. A bakery is kind of a mini factory, right?
True.
Yeah, you build bread in a very industrialized fashion. It's a standardized product, but then you also sell it on site.
Mm-hmm.
And so, factory is when that distinction can be made, that the sole purpose of manufacturing is, okay, I have some goods coming in, I have some refined goods coming out and then sold somewhere else.
Interesting. I don't think we think about that too much in the days today and nowadays. We more or less think that, well, everything's kind of distributed and you can buy it anywhere. But you're absolutely right. The bakery is a really good example of it being baked there and then basically put onto the shelf, which is probably 2 meters away, and then being sold directly, a factory sale, basically.
Yeah.
And it's very rare in other cases. I don't think there's many, you know, there's this kind of like with clothes, rarely like a factory sale where we go to the factory and buy something, but it's more like a discount or outlet store type of scenario. Normally you'd go to a shop and buy it there. That's very interesting because it makes a huge difference, actually.
Yeah, but I think you can still see these old ways of building things. When you go, for example, to the Arab world,
mm-hmm.
you see that in the old towns, you still have streets where, you know, there's a certain type of craft where everything is under one place.
Mm-hmm.
You have, yeah. But that's getting very rare even there. And for us, obviously, it's very hard to find meanwhile.
Oh, yeah, very hard to find. Do you think it's because it's easier to produce a lot of goods in one place, like a bigger factory which is centralized? Or is it because of standardization as well? Because if you have, like with the different looms, they probably all have their own working style and might have produced different quality.
Well, I think what comes in is capitalism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly you have a production factor labor and a production factor money.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you have to people just concentrated the money in one place, and so suddenly everybody had to come to that place to make stuff.
Yeah. Of course. And where does then Industry 2.0 start?
Yeah, so the big shift is then in the second half of the 19th century towards the 20th century, when we suddenly go from the steam engine or coal-based manufacturing to electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens then is that you become much more flexible. In the first place, you had these, you had just one motor in the factory, but then you could have like lots of small motors everywhere. You were very flexible in how you arrange the factory, and then suddenly you had specialized machineries also popping up, and the biggest one is the production line,
mm-hmm.
right? So suddenly you have a motorized production line, and you had already split up a production into small steps, you know, what is called Taylorism.
Yeah.
So everybody just does one thing and does it over and over. And so the actual work was still done by humans, but the humans had to adapt to the technology that suddenly starts to surround them.
Yeah.
And obviously, the benefits are clear. We get mass production in place. Things like everything from building materials to cars, eventually with Henry Ford. But it basically was a pervasive shift in the whole society. And I think it started already in the 19th century when you think about things, for example, cast iron.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the Victorian era, you had a lot of buildings that suddenly started to use cast iron, beautiful cast iron constructions. But they were already mass produced. That was not like the output from a craftsperson then.
Mm-hmm.
But so now it becomes pervasive, and we see that in the early 20th century with things like architecture really starting to embrace that, or things like furniture design starting to embrace that. It's basically after the World War One where the whole Bauhaus movement mm-hmm. started to kick in and said, okay, this is the new world. We're going to build products around this idea of modularization, about standardization, about mass production. And the idea there is that it becomes democratized so that everybody can now buy not only one closet in their lives, but basically have the same opportunities as previously only a very small, a very rich part of the population.
Which is obviously like also quite amazing that through mass production, a lot of the goods that were really like only for high class got really available for everyone. I mean, without the production that you just mentioned from Henry Ford, I don't think that the car production would have ramped up as fast as it did at that point and made it possible for more people to buy cars. Do you have any information about, because we talk a lot about the about Henry Ford being one of the first people like really putting out the standardized way of building cars. But in Europe, there must have been also the same movement going on at the same time, right?
It was a globalized world already by then, right? By then you had telegraphs and telephones and mass media. So I think the ideas spread extremely quickly.
That's interesting. It's interesting to think how different it was at that time. Now we have YouTube and we have Zoom calls and you know, video calls, and you can basically visit a factory without ever being there, or you can just take a plane, which, you know, takes a few minutes to book on the Lufthansa website, and you can fly there. At that point, traveling from one country to another to see it in action is like basically a 3 month job, which is quite impressive.
Yeah, but I think that the changes in technology and the surroundings were at least as profound back then than it is today. I mean, you can always see it with the changes in society. I think all the conflicts starting from communism to World War One. I mean, these are all things that like wouldn't have happened without the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about if you were born in 1870 and you lived until 90 years old, then you would have seen the introduction of electricity, of cars, of the plane eventually, and you would have died when people were sending satellites into space. So
yeah.
I think we cannot really understand what these people have gone through.
Yeah, that's true.
Changes. It's
amazing. I mean, maybe it's a bit. I don't want to say it's the same, but it might be similar. So we've seen the introduction of the internet, which I think is very interesting. I don't think it was that intimidating. But I think what is very intimidating right is now the speed of AI, how it's progressing. And that is also like a big shift, not for everyone right now, but it feels like a very monumental change. And the progression is being exponential right now. It feels like a very intimidating moment to be in. And then obviously, on the other hand, like seeing rocket ships land again is also something that is quite crazy.
It is. I think it has accelerated. I mean, I've been trying to be on top of technology shifts all my life, mm-hmm. but even for me, it becomes kind of awkward meanwhile.
Yeah.
But I think the silver lining from at least the second Industrial Revolution is that you can survive it. I hope that we don't get the same amount of conflict as then. But in hindsight, it at least you can understand it, and it becomes less of a unknown area, right? So in hindsight, we can analyze it and really understand what was going on.
One thing I really find fascinating and also about Robco, obviously, and your role at Robco is that the whole team is working on something that actually is directly impacting this time, this area, and also the progression of this space. So finding somebody who's more in tune with what's happening today than you and the Robco team obviously is very hard, because you guys are really at the forefront of what's happening. So you're really in that moment, and that's something really special.
We are part of an industry that is, meanwhile, obviously very big. There's an industry for the industry, so we're part of that. But I think the more profound question is, obviously, where does it take us, right? And I guess we're going to talk about that.
Yes, exactly. So let's move on to Industry 3.0. Where does that start and what does it mean?
Well, at some point, we start to have computers.
Mm-hmm.
And computers mean information processing. So I think it basically started when we understood that we can express every kind of information through bits and bytes, right? That was the profound change in the 1940s, where suddenly we had papers like from Claude Shannon, where he just said, okay, we can do everything, all the information processing in the digital world, and so obviously people started to take advantage much earlier than many people think, right? Basically, since computers have been invented and have been around, and obviously then in the 1960s also with robots.
Interesting.
So now, I mean, there's several things. One is a factory can be seen as a signal processing machine. Mm-hmm. So lots of things change, and once you have a sensor in place, then you have the opportunity to control things. And the term cybernetics came about. Cybernetics is such a sci-fi term, but it becomes much clearer when you think that everybody has a cyber physical system at home, which is a thermostat, right?
Yeah.
So what is a thermostat? It's you have a target function that you want to achieve. You want to reach a certain temperature. You have a sensor, which is the current temperature, and you have an actuator, which is, okay, I can turn up the heat up and down. And so now the target function is, okay, I want to maintain a constant temperature. And so suddenly you have a controller, right? Because if you turn it up too quickly, then it overshoots. And so suddenly you need some dampening. And so that's a cyber physical system. It's cybernetics means I have this circle, mm-hmm. circular feedback cycle, and physical just means I'm doing it in the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
And so people haven't talked about that term in particular, but they have started to build robots using these things. They have started to build signal processing system for whole factories where you just say, okay, if something gets to a certain point, then like a signal, like a switch gets flipped and I can trigger other things in the factory. And so these programmable logic controllers started to get into the factories, and so now you could automate the whole factory. So that was basically Industry 3.0. It obviously goes on until today, but then we suddenly get to accrue a lot of data. And mm-hmm. so that's then where the next step comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And there, it's now we're getting into the space where it's not like the terms are not defined by historians anymore.
Yeah.
Right? Industry 2.0 was described in 1969 or something. Whereas right now it's more like, okay, how can we describe what's currently going on? Or how can we describe what we want it to be in the future? So that's more like the discussion around Industry 4.0 and 5.0. Yeah. So 4.0 was a nice term because it was at the time when everybody had just talked about Web 2.0. So the whole 0.0 thing was pretty common. And it came actually from the German government, who said, okay, we need a technology strategy. So they gathered a bunch of very smart folks and a bunch of very powerful folks and wrote this concept paper where they coined the term. It was a very national thing. And then 5 years later, it was picked up by the head of the World Economic Forum. And they did a session there. They wrote an article and later a book where they called it the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And now I think looking at it now, I always thought, wasn't that about IoT and connecting digital devices? And I think that's what most people think about when they think about Industry 4.0. So there was a time when, okay, so suddenly you have all these sensors. Now, what if I have more devices talk to each other? And so suddenly I can maybe coordinate things within the factory from the sensor level to the whole factory level. I can build digital twins so I can watch how things are going and maybe even make predictions how mm-hmm. things should be going. But I could also see it in a broader context, like, okay, what does it mean for the supply chain? Can I connect different factories? And then it becomes a complex dynamic system. And so I mean, obviously in computer science, there's a lot of work around all these issues and a lot of products that have been built around all these issues. And I think that was a major part of what that thing described in 2011. And it was also the time when you weren't allowed to talk about AI.
Yeah. Okay.
Right? AI was a kind of a burned term by then. People have been trying to build AI systems since the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
But it was up and down. And in the 70s, there was a big crash. In the 1980s, people were doing rule-based systems, and in the 1990s, people were calling it machine learning. So the term AI doesn't show up in these papers at all. So then they try to find these other terms. So cyber-physical system is the one that shows up in that paper, and there was a vision presented there, which I actually have it written up because it's actually quite interesting that it predicts the world from now,
yeah,
pretty well, but also kind of not quite. So this was a prediction how the factory in 2025 would look like. So it says, using sensors, robots capture and interpret acoustic and visual data, then derive actions from them. They can hear and see. They recognize workers in their vicinity and adjust their behavior. If a worker comes too close, they autonomously move out of the way. A worker can beckon a service robot and issue verbal commands. The robot then hands over tools and assists in transporting heavy workpieces from one production station to the next, and so on. So I think there is already the notion of, okay, so you need an AI for that,
yeah,
like language, like speech recognition, understanding the visual environment, moving in the individual environment. But then there was also the whole idea of a cobot back then, which was very much in like a hyped thing. So there was the idea that you would have robots standing next to you and basically working together with you all the time. And it turns out that this hasn't been as much in demand as people thought back then, because out of safety reasons, you always have to slow down the robot, and so eventually we had regulations that made the robot slow. So then, when you have the choice between making it fast but then not be around humans, or making it slow, then people actually usually chose the faster one.
Yeah.
Other things are interesting that they're so far off. So having a robot follow me and handing me tools, like, why doesn't it do the job itself?
Exactly,
right? That doesn't make any sense. So I think, and that all comes down to, okay, how far have we gotten with the manipulation part?
Yeah.
So apparently they didn't see that manipulation would be in the factory of 2025. And we already see the start of that happening.
Yeah, it's interesting how different the view is. And then obviously, like, it makes totally sense to think about, like, I have a robot helping me carry heavy stuff around. But then obviously, like, this is something I also learned talking to you about, that this is like really interesting how a robot is just so different to a human still. And obviously, if the robot crashes into you as a human, you get really hurt. It's not the same as if another human runs into you. You know, that's like two airbags running against each other, kind of, right? But with a robot, that's like hard metal hitting you, and
absolutely,
that's no fun. And I'm we're gonna talk about it later, but I saw also the robots, how clumsy they can be, and especially talking about giving them more freedom, this can be dangerous. And that's why I think it's a good idea, and it's actually a better idea to have the robot do it, because he will actually do it quite well. And if it works, right? Obviously, it's still a way to go there, but if he can do it, then he'll probably do a better job and do it for a long time.
Yeah, but I think just thinking pragmatically, if you can isolate the robot and not have it be able to hurt humans, that's always the preferred option. There is a lot of work happening on safety, which is basically two things. One is you can react on impact, but then the more interesting part is, okay, can you predict that an impact is going to happen? We see, for example, autonomous driving. Obviously, that's a huge thing. You have to always be in the future and react with things like the length of the braking. I don't know the English term. But you have to be in the future all the time to make your decisions right now.
Yeah. I mean, that is definitely a challenge. So where do you see Industry 5.0 being right now? Is it already happening? Can you describe it a bit more? Is it like replacing Industry 4.0 right now, or is it coexisting and it's becoming this new thing?
So 5.0 is another thing, right? Up to now, we were at 4.0.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that again was written mostly by people from the industry,
mm-hmm.
or at least from research who came in with, okay, what's the technological enabler for continuing to do what we've already been doing, just in a more efficient way? Now, Industry 5.0 is something that the European Commission has written up, which comes in from a completely different angle. It's more like a normative description of, okay, where do we want to be mm-hmm. as a society with industry? I think the main keyword here is human-centric rather than machine-centric. when we first thought about the whole area, and actually also before I again went in and looked at all the keywords that are being presented, I thought, okay, Industry 4.0, that to me is like signal processing, and maybe you have big data and that you can analyze and do some machine learning on top and so on. The whole area of, okay, now we have AI, I mean, only has come about really in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of, okay, what is the next step? Then I would say we are in this mode of having AI as the enabler for some really fundamental shift. And so for me, Industry 5.0 from a technological standpoint is going to be purely around this term of AI. Now,
mm-hmm.
what are the consequences? That is the interesting part. So from, obviously, if we can shape policies, if we can shape technology, if we can shape the business environment, it can become something that is human-centered, something that produces more sustainable products,
mm-hmm.
and something where, what's the term again?
So, resilience.
Resilience, right. So where we have a more resilient ecosystem. Why the term resilience? Because this concept paper is also a response to the COVID pandemic, where we see that we now have, driven by Industry 4.0 and all the communication and internet and ships being monitored through GPS and so on, we have built an extremely efficient system, but it's not resilient, because resiliency and efficiency are kind of counterparts. They, okay. You can see that when you call a call center. So an efficient call center is when you have very few people working in the call center.
Yeah.
But then we have this concept that randomly people call in and you start to get queues,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you have a resilient system, then you would have more operators. But it's not efficient, right? You would have to take the risk of people doing nothing. But suddenly you can get through all the time. So that makes it clear what is the trade-off between resiliency and efficiency. So now if we want to have a resilient system, a resilient factory system, or a resilient economic system, then we would have to take this into account. And obviously systems are so complex that AI is one of the major ways to maintain this, if at least if we want to keep the complexity of our economies.
Very interesting that you're talking about the resiliency versus the efficiency. And you can see that in a lot of supply chains as well. And you mentioned COVID. There was, I think, very interesting was the medical supply chain that broke down instantly because at one point something was missing. And even for the big car manufacturers who are using basically very fast supply chain logics, right? So the parts they needed would be delivered just in time and then be used. And as soon as one of them broke, the whole production floor had to be stopped because, I don't know, like 100 parts were missing to produce the next 100 cars. And that is not resilient. But obviously, if you put them in your lot, right, if you put them outside and store them, then that's very expensive. Resilient.
Yeah. I mean, everybody was talking about lean production for decades. So, what influences this is the economies of production, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have more and more complex machines to build more and more mass-produced things, then it becomes more and more expensive to put them in one place. So suddenly they are geographically dispersed. There might be also complex in the sense that not a lot of people can produce them. So suddenly you get these very complicated webs. So I think one challenge here is to understand, do we actually need all this complexity? Couldn't we just, go back and see how we can do with much simpler technologies as well? There was an example where, if you build a huge apartment building, it's just a lot of components that you need to put together, right? For example, windows. Windows is a mass-produced product. You need to order it. It comes from, I don't know, a different country being sent to you, and you probably don't want to order more than necessary, right? If like 150 years ago, you would build a new neighborhood, you would call the carpenter and say, okay, this is the hole. I need 70 holes filled with windows.
Yes.
And I would just do it on the spot.
Yeah.
Right? And so the question is there a new market for products where, for one, we cannot really go back in doing everything by hand? It's just too expensive. Like, we could do that in the 19th century because we had people working for pennies. People who had no other choice. They maybe couldn't read. They just came to the cities and had to survive, right? Yeah. Sometimes we had these cases where people were just paid nothing but coupons that they needed to spend in the shops that the factory owner provided, right? Yeah. And then otherwise they had nothing. So we are in a very different situation there. And in the meantime, we, like in Europe at least, or in the US, we exported the question of hiring cheap labor to countries while they were going through the same process as we did 150 years ago.
Yeah.
So we profited a lot from a country like China opening up and suddenly being very cheap. Now this is changing as well. So we're running out of these resources. So we need to have something in order to maintain the prosperity that we have, right? And so for me, the only way is, other than bringing up these huge, like extremely tailed distributions of income, that we need to have these workers being very similar to what a human worker is, right? And I think it will never really replace the human worker, but it will form this third area of manufacturing where you can do certain things, more and more things, but you cannot really replace everything that a human does. But you also cannot replace everything that a mass production line does, or like a dark factory where everything is automated end-to-end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that basically means that the next evolution step, if we do not have, I would say, a cheaper workforce, is then to have robots really helping us to keep that prosperity up. And what would interest me is, I mean, you mentioned the three pillars that the European Commission said in 2021, human centricity, sustainability, and resilience. I think those three pillars are very interesting that they mentioned these. I mean, let's see that they don't create too many harsh regulations around them, but tell me a bit more about what Robco's role is in this Industry 5.0 and how you're going to work with these three pillars and create something there.
Yeah. So what we're doing is we're building AI-based products. In the end, our goal is to have robots that where the human-robot interaction is very simple. We had the example with talking to a robot.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not the ideal thing in a factory, which is very noisy. But we have the technology today to make things much more simple. Yeah. And rather than having somebody operate a CAD program and large computer screens with 1,500 buttons, it could become much more natural for the human to interact with the machine. So that's the human centricity. There are other things like from the resilience part, I would say we cannot deal only with these rigid objects anymore that we used to do in the mass production times. We can deal with things coming back, for example, like broken things. We're talking about things like a recycling plant or even like waste sorting, right? Where you have suddenly very complicated shapes. You need to make decisions. Is it good or bad? Things that even a few years ago would have been extremely hard to automate, really. And so I think AI-based robotics and AI-based industry can help getting to the next level there and creating a more sustainable future.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting, like especially like waste sorting seems to be, it's very valuable. Waste's very valuable, right? But obviously, like there's always going to be wrong stuff in the waste, and I think it's very interesting to see how AI is such really good at pattern detection. Also, the machine learning parts were also really good, but then you know picking it out and picking different objects out, I think, is a very interesting skill. Obviously, like right now, it's put on a long assembly line, and then things are like sorted out with different mechanisms. But in the end, there's still workers. They're looking at the stuff that's going through and picking some stuff out. I think that that's very valuable. And to go back to the point we just had before, I think like if nobody wants to work in factories anymore, robots have to be the solution, right? They have to be the solution. And one thing that I find really interesting, at least from this Industry 5.0 perspective, is like it seems to be a shift from efficiency first to a value first mindset in the industry. And I wonder how that is essential for true sustainability in manufacturing. Because at the end of the day, you want both, right? You want efficiency, but you also want sustainability in your manufacturing process as the company owner. This value part is a very interesting concept to put that in there, because it's not the first thing that comes to mind when you're looking at capitalism or a company making money.
I just think it means that purely optimizing for efficiency is one way. It's an important way. We'll stay there, but if you think, for example, about resiliency, we're talking about being able to reconfigure a factory much much more efficiently. So suddenly, what if the economies change of a factory setup, and these initial costs come down? Then you can be much more resilient, because you can react better to changing environments. So I think the vision from the European Union makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see the connection with the technology that we have. I can see the connection with what we're doing as Robco. And I think it will become the big shift enabled by AI that people are anticipating right now.
Yeah. I mean, I can definitely see that when you have a factory stocked with Robco technology, then the rearming of the factory is much faster and easier, because you can human-centric interact with the robot. Also, one thing is that you can reuse all the parts. You don't have to throw anything away. So you have the sustainability and you have the resilience, because you can basically do it by yourself, right? Because that is something where Robco is really at the forefront, is making the interaction with the programming of the robot so easy that I don't want to say anybody can do it, but nearly. Like, it's very, very easy to do, and it's very it takes less effort to do it, which is quite crazy. And then obviously something that is also creating resilience is that we have Robco in the European Union, you know, creating robots and creating this great technology with AI and the robots manufacturing, that we have more resilience there. So it's a full circle.
Right. So I think for us, it's important that we think about the customer that doesn't want to invest large sums in the factory setup itself. We want to make it as human centric as possible. Mm-hmm. And we have the robot as a service as a core pillar, which means we also are incentivized to make the operation of the robot as efficient as possible, which leads to things like modularity, being able to replace parts rather than the whole robot. So I think it all plays together, and it gives us a good framing of where we want to be in, you know, the next years.
And I think for everybody who's listening, you should definitely look at one of the other podcasts that we did, where we talked especially about how the interaction with a robot from Robco can work and how the ideas are there for the future. Like, there's different receptors, there's different sensors, there's different types of communication you can have with a Robco robot, and also with, obviously, like with the whole industry of robots, what is being planned there. And I think that's also quite interesting to understand how human centric we are already, like how far we are along on the way. And you're always, every month there's a new development on your side. So that's very interesting. And obviously the idea of talking to a robot, giving it commands, maybe in a factory setting, is not ideal, but I think that's why there was such a breakthrough in AI. I think it was because of this test product that OpenAI launched, where you could interact with a computer in a natural language. And I think that was the breakthrough that AI needed to become a mass solution. And maybe that is also in some kind of way the solution for interacting on a human-centric level with robots.
Yeah, I already know people who are only talking to their computers. Yes. They're writing software just by sitting in an armchair.
Yeah,
talking to it. So yeah, I think, I mean, obviously it always starts with the developers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But for sure, we will see these kind of developments on the factory floor. Doesn't have to be voice. I think showing something will become better and better. It will be a process, right? You always overestimate how far you can get in a year.
Yes.
You underestimate how far you can get in 10.
Yes.
So I think there is a profound change happening right now, and we're part of this whole journey.
Thank you, Clemens. And I think that is the best closing note ever. It's like to say, okay, I think also Robco does a lot in 1 year, what I've been seeing for the journey, but you really underestimate what you can, you really overestimate what you can achieve in 12 months in 1 year. But I think everybody underestimates how far we'll be in 10 years, looking at Robco, looking at the industry, and looking also at the development, because then we'll be at like 2036 or something like that, which will be quite interesting. And maybe we'll have already full running robot factories. Very, very cool. Thank you so much. And everybody, please, like, if you found this podcast episode interesting, please give us a like, also subscribe to the channel, obviously, and leave a comment if you have some questions. We'll be happy to answer them. And obviously, don't forget to send it to somebody who's interested in the topic or who wants to know more about Robco, and send them this podcast to, you know, dive into Robco a little bit more. And yeah, if you want to have a practical look at what Industry 5.0 is, please go and visit robco.co, rob.co, that's the new domain, and visit them there. And have a great time. And I can't wait to see you next time when we have the next episode of Rob Talk. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for being here. It's amazing.
This is Rob Talk, a podcast by Robco. Subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. See you on the factory floor.